The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
My name is Wendy Phillips. I teach third grade at Trinitas Christian School in Pensacola, Florida. I am so excited to tell you about this project that I've been working on. So we're going to pray, and then we're going to get started. So let's pray. Gracious and Holy Father, thank you for being a kind Father and making us your people. Thank you for calling us to do this good work. Give us wisdom and energy and rest as we do the hard work of teaching and training our students to be mighty warriors in your kingdom. I pray that we will use what we learn at this workshop to cultivate wisdom and virtue in our students and thereby bring glory to your name. In the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, amen. The only thing that you really need to know about me is that when I come up and get something new, or a new project, or a new task, I go, I am not smart enough to do that. I cannot do that. And so I stew for a few days, and I worry, and I think I'm going to get an easier job, like coal mining or lumberjacking. And then I come to my senses, I realize God will help me, and then I just tuck into it, and then I can do it. And so my background is not what you're about to hear today. My background is music. And so I grew up knowing nothing, practically nothing about history. I didn't enjoy history. And so when I came to Trinitas in view of a job, my job was to teach a history lesson. It was the last history card in the ancient Greece and Rome set. It was the fall of the Western Roman Empire. And I barely knew that there was a Roman Empire, let alone a Western Roman Empire. And so I, you know, had a few days of turmoil. My husband wisely said, just see what you can do. If it doesn't work out, you can call Mr. Trotter and tell him you're not interested. Once I started digging into the story of the Roman Empire and the Western Roman Empire, I got so excited, I could not get enough of it. And so I got that job. So I don't know why they hired me if they knew how little I knew. But over the years, I've gained a little bit of knowledge. But anyhow, that was a turning point in my educational career. I had just been teaching. And so that was a turning point. I don't know if you've ever had turning points in your educational career. But there's something about a turning point that just infuses your life with greater life, greater knowledge, and greater vim and vigor. And so I'm going to tell you about this project today. I hope that this will do it. Another turning point I had in my teaching career is several years ago, went over to Bayshore Academy in Fairhope. Shout out to Bayshore. And I saw things there that told me I'm doing most of the work for my students. And so I came back from Bayshore. I had a million ideas that I wanted to do. My brain would not shut off. It was just like a factory of ideas. That was another turning point in my educational career. So then, at the end of last year, our very brilliant academic dean, Justin Hughes, put a task upon the grammar teachers. I had been teaching the card 29, the Constantine and the Edict of Milan, for those of you that teach the Veritas set. And in my curriculum, there was a printout that said project, and it was the Edict of Milan. And I've always done that piece of paper as a project. And so we did that. I had my students highlight the main ideas. We read it. I had them restate the main ideas. Mr. Hughes' son was in my class, so his son went home with that piece of paper, and he asked Timothy, what is the Edict of Milan about? And he could tell him those main points. And so Mr. Hughes said every grammar teacher needs to be doing that in their history class. They need to be using primary sources. I'd heard that phrase, primary sources, that term, but I knew that it was the logic and rhetoric teachers who use primary sources. And for me, that piece of paper in my binder was not really a primary source. It was a project. And so so it was not new to him of what a primary source was, but that was new to me. So my first response, of course, is, I'm not smart enough to do this. And I flipped and flopped for a few nights, and then I thought, just tuck into it. Come on, Wendy, just do it. And oh my goodness, I'm going to tell you, it's been the richest project I have worked on in my entire educational career. And something that I thought was impossible to do became very possible. I learned so much. What I got out of it, I'm not kidding you, it actually has changed the way I think. It has changed my perception of knowledge. And even more than that, what my students have gotten from it is it is the icing on the cake. It's probably the cake. I'm probably icing this cake. But anyhow, the way they responded told me children love to learn. I already knew that. But you lay it out in front of them, and they can get it, and they can do it, and they can love it. And so it changed my history class. And I'm going to show you ways that it did that. So that's all you need. If I can do it, you can do it. Okay? I did not know words like Eusebius and Suetonius and things like that, names like that. And so, but now I love those names. And I love those books that those names are related to. So let's get started. I cannot see the PowerPoint from here, but thankfully I'm not tethered to the stage. What Mr. Hughes did at the end of the year is we had an in-service, and he walked us through step by step how to find primary sources. And so the first question he asked was, how do we know it happened? Most of us have books, shelves full of history books. Well, how does the writer of the history book know it happened? Can we trust that writer? How do you know if you can trust that writer to accurately report what happened in history? How does he or she know? So that question that he asked is the one that you want to stick with. How do we know it happened? And so we go back to a primary source. Now, primary source is a document or an artifact or a painting that gives us an eyewitness account of the event. And the closer it is to the event, the better, okay? So we want to get as close to that event. So a history book written in 1996 is not a primary source. We want to go all the way back to a primary source. And so he gave us the task of doing 10 history cards in this first year. I went ahead and did all 32. sorry. for professional development reasons. But once you get into it, it is so interesting. It is so interesting. I found this book about Constantine's life. They were communications to Eusebius. And as I read those words of Constantine, I thought, how privileged are we to have those words? The words that Constantine, in a different language, but the words that he wrote. And so you get into the life of those ancients when you read what they wrote or what somebody who lived in the same time wrote about them. All right, so let's see if this works. All right, there's that history book that a lot of us use. And so what we want to do is continually ask this question, this is the most important question: how do we know these events happened? Nope, wrong way. Good. All right. So there are some things that I want my students to discover. Remember, I told you that turning point where I realized I was telling them everything. I want them to tell me. You give a child a spade at the beach, he's not going to lay it up on the shore and go play. He's going to use that spade. I want them to dig. And so this is some of the things that I want them to discover. First of all, I want them to discover the answer to how do we know it happened. I want them to know the author's point of view. Is it Pliny, the younger, writing as a friend to Tacitus? Is it the book of Esther, writing from the perspective of a Jewess and not as a Persian? Is it Herodotus, who's writing years later, after what he observed? And it's just what point of view they're writing it from. So the next thing I want them to discover is the proximity to the time of the event. Here I have the proximity. That means how close to the event was it? So was it an eyewitness like Pliny the Younger? Or was it generations later, hundreds of years later, like Herodotus? When was it written? I want them to discover the purpose for writing. I'm going to refer to Pliny a lot because I have a slide about that. But Pliny wrote to Tacitus. Tacitus said, tell me what happened to your uncle the day that Mount Vesuvius erupted. And Pliny wrote a letter to him, told the whole story of what happened to his uncle. And then Tacitus wrote back and said, oh, are you and your mother okay? And so Pliny wrote another letter and said, just to let you know, this is your idea. You're not going to be able to use this for preserving history. You just wanted to know how we are. I'm going to tell you how we are. I love that because, yes, he preserved history with that beautiful letter. Livy wanted to make heroes out of the founders of Rome. That was his purpose. I also want them to know who the audience was. Sometimes we don't always know who the audience is, but was it for the Greeks or the Jews or the Romans? I'm going to use the ancient world mostly because that's where I teach, but this is applicable to any period of time. Was it for posterity? Herodotus said that he wrote the histories so that the story of time wasn't faded. So what is the purpose in the author's purpose? The genre, was it a letter or a speech or a funeral oration, like Pericles' funeral oration? Was it a poem like the Iliad, the Odyssey? Was it just a narrative like Herodotus's histories? Is it a document like the Declaration of Independence? Is it an art piece like the bull leaping fresco in the Minoan Palace? The original language, and you'll see the document, a picture of the document that I hand out to them. Sometimes I do put a snippet from the original language, just so they can see what Greek and Latin and so forth. No Spanish, but you know. The corroboration of information, does it support what we've already learned Or does it change our minds? So we were reading a primary source selection from Suetonius, the Lives of the 12 Caesars, about Nero. And in this selection, it told the story about Nero, thinking that he was this Olympic champion, better than all the rest. And yet his only job at the Olympics was to drag the wrestlers back into the ring if they got out of the ring. Okay, not quite the Olympic champion that you think, you know. And he considered himself to be the best flutist. But he did that by killing off everybody else that was better than him. So when we read, I can tell my students, we can read the history card. I can tell my students, Nero was the worst persecutor of Christians in ancient history. And they're going to say, I'll say, who was Nero? Nero was the ancient man, okay? But then we read about Nero, and we read what kind of man he was. I don't even have to say he was this. They can pick up on that, and they can tell me the character of Nero. You just lay it out there, and they can do it. So in my artwork, I showed a picture of Nero's Remorse, is the name of the painting. It's a young Nero. He's laying on his bed like a pouty teenager, and he looks sad. Supposedly, he's experiencing remorse after having murdered his mother. And so, see, you're laughing because you know that's not consistent with what we actually read about Nero from the primary source. And they picked up on that immediately. I put the picture up there, and we'll get to how to do that with our art later. But they could even tell me, I don't think he would be remorseful about killing his mother. Now, it's not always true that 2 and 2 equal 4 in a third grader's world. Sometimes we're missing part, an add-end or something. We're missing part of the information. But you can see how now they're not just sitting there and they're going to regurgitate it. They're engaged in what's happening in the life of Nero. What is Nero like? What is inconsistent with what I already know about Nero? Okay? The other thing I want them to know is what we do in third grade. I could teach history for 2 hours a day. There is so much out there, but you can't get to it all. So what I want them to know is there is so much more to know about this topic, and I want you to spend the rest of your life getting it. That's what I want them to do. And so normally I'll say, what do you want to know about Nero or Julius Caesar or whatever? They'll ask questions. At the beginning of the week, I write those questions on the board. And I'll say, perhaps in the course of our study this week, we'll find answers to those questions, or you might want to go home and do a little bit of research. We get to the end of the week, we've marked off what we've discovered, the answers that we've gotten. The end of the week, we always have questions we could not answer. That is A-okay. I'll tell them, there's so much to learn about this. I want you to spend the rest of your life learning about this, okay? So you don't have to answer every question. You cannot answer every question, because none of us in here are that big. I don't know if you could learn something new about history as well, perhaps what's a little known fact, according to Gary Larson. But anyhow, I'm going to tell you now, this is my favorite slide, not because I love Far Side, but it's the response of my students. And I'm going to come back to this, and I'm going to put up the points that I'm going to tell you. So you'll have a chance at the end. You can copy down. But basically, the perks of doing primary sources are the law of the teaching process, the law of the learning process. And this is what the law of the teaching process is. Don't teach, don't tell a child anything that he can discover for himself. That has been a gold mine this year in my class. So they've become deeply, deeply interested in each topic. I'll say, let's do our primary source work. Thank you, Mrs. Phillips. And they get their highlighter. It's like they're at the table waiting for the feast to be served. That highlighter is like their knife and fork, and they're ready to dive into that deliciousness. They have become engaged in the lesson on their own. The second law of teaching is the student must attend with interest. And guess what? That's not their job. That is your job to lay that feast before them and entice them to choose that feast, that bountiful feast, over a dried up burrito from Taco Bell. Okay? So not to diss Taco Bell, but in other words, they have come to love the rich and the deep and the complex and the things that they have to work hard at to understand. And so it went from Mrs. Phillips teaches the class, I give it back to Mrs. Phillips, we play a review game on Thursday, we take a test on Friday. No more of that. Primary sources will help your students dive into ancient history and love what they find there. So the learning process is the student must reproduce in his own mind the lesson to be taught. And so through the week, as we just casually talk about these events in history, and we're wondering, and we're thinking, and we're dialoguing, and somebody says this, and somebody says, I don't think that's consistent with what we already learned. Can you see how I don't have to say, sit up and attend with interest? They are captivated. And when they give it back to me, it is not a rote answer. It's not a rote sentence or paragraph. They are actually telling about somebody that they've just lived a whole week with. Okay? So that's my favorite part of all of this. Yes, I've enjoyed what I've read and what I've learned, but to see my students respond like parched travelers in a desert, and I've got this oasis for them, and they're so grateful, and they've responded so well. All right, so these are our tasks today, and we're going to go one by one, so I don't want you to worry. And you don't have to copy this down yet, but I just want you to see what we're going to do today. So today we are going to find primary sources. And you have a gold mine in your handout. I've given you primary sources, just a bunch of them, okay? We're going to choose selections from our primary source. I'm going to show you how to do that. I'm going to show you how to curate art, artifacts, and maps. And then I'm going to tell you how to develop graphic organizers. I can tell you that 1 and 2 is my favorite. 3 is my favorite. And 4 is my favorite, just so that you know. Yes. All right. And now, drum roll, the moment you've been waiting for. How to use primary sources and 4 easy steps. I will not give you a toaster if you buy this now, but you will get much more. The first thing is understand the event. The second thing is find your source. The third thing is select something pertinent. And the fourth thing is read it with your students. We're going to do those one by one, but I'll leave it up there for you a second. All right. I'm going to go on. Is that okay? Because you'll be able to write these down again. Okay. So step 1, understand the event by reading about it. You're going to read your history card. If you don't use history cards, you're going to read whatever has been given to you in your curriculum. You're going to get a good understanding of the event. You can read books like Streams of Civilization. I have shelves full of books that just tell the stories of what's happening. You cannot teach the Three Punic Wars if you don't know the Three Punic Wars. You cannot teach about the Persian War if you do not know about the Persian War. So your first step is just read it. Read something from here, read something from there, read something from there, and get a good understanding of the story. All right, step two. Find your source using Susan Wise Bauer's History of the Ancient World. I talked with somebody yesterday, so I know they use this book. Susan Wise Bauer has two other books in this particular series and many, many books. You do not have to use her book if you have some other book that you can go to, but I'm telling you, this is your ticket to finding your primary sources, okay? For those of you that teach modern history, you have a wealth in primary sources, in documents, in letters, and I gave you a separate page of primary resources for those of you that teach American history. You won't find American history in these books. So this is the book that I use, Susan Wise Bauer. What you want to do first is you want to get a lay of the land. You want to figure out how is the book set up. Okay, it's not set up like a lot of books where it says ancient Greece and it tells all about ancient Greece, ancient Rome. It's going to tell you what happened by time, okay? So the first part is how things all got started, and the second part is first things, and then empires, and it's going to tell you about the Assyrian Empire and the Egyptian Empire and the ancient Greece and ancient Rome. It's going to tell you all of how those empires got started. So you can look in the table of contents to find your topic, because it'll have it listed out for you, or you can go to the index either way, okay? So once you've found your topic, then you're going to go to that page or that chapter. You're going to read that chapter, get a further understanding of the event, and then you're going to look for passages that have little tiny numbers. I'm going to show you this in just a second. But there'll be the little citation numbers, and that's what you're interested in the most. So you go back to the back, to the appendix, and it's set up chapter by chapter, just like it is in the book, okay? And then you look for your number, and then you see who wrote it, okay? Now, you want to pick names like Homer, Josephus, Herodotus, Livy, Suetonius, names like that. Joe Mooney is not a primary source, okay? You're not looking for names like that. Now, here's one of my favorite things. When I first started, I found something. I went back to it the next day. It was still there. It was great, okay? So it doesn't disappear, okay? And once you figure out, if I found something on one day, I can find it again. You are good to go, okay? All right, now I'm going to show you how to do this. If you don't want to use this book, or you don't have this book, or don't know if your period of history is not in here, ask one of your logic and rhetoric teachers. They use primary sources all the time, and they will help you. Okay, so this is what this looks like. This is my history card, Pompeii Burns. This history card 28 in the Veritas set. And so you see, I went to the chapter 82. I've circled it for you, the edges of the Roman world. I read the chapter, and this is what I found. I found a paragraph, a quote from a primary source, and there's the number. So I went to the appendix. I found, look, chapter 82. And I found Pliny, letters, and it tells me what book. And it tells me what letter. So it's in book 6, letter 20. You can see there's Hooper. Hooper is not a primary source. Feel free to read him, but he's not your primary source. You want to go to the primary source. If we get time, I'm going to read a little section of a Pliny letter that'll make your heart beat hard. Okay, step three, you're going to select something pertinent from the primary source online or in a book. So here I have the letters of Pliny the Younger. And so here is book six. Here is letter number 16, where he wrote to Tacitus and told how his uncle died. And then my source right there said letter 20, and there's where he told about how he and his mother fared during the eruption. Now, you'll notice on the screen that I showed before, it said letter 20, but you can see how interesting it is. I couldn't just stay at letter 20. I went this way and I went that way to find more. That's what you want your students to do. You want them to say, I want more, okay? They won't want more if you don't want more, okay? I know more, less is more, but if less is more, think how much more is, okay? So I'm going to tell you, I have not typed one word of a primary source for the handout that I give to my students. Everything is online. I have given you that wealth. It's a year-long effort to get those sources together. And I want you to want to do this. And so I've given you the resources for it. You just cut and paste, put it in your document, okay? Or type it out. All right, that's step three. So whatever you select, make sure it's pertinent to your lesson. And if it's too hard, don't worry. Do not underestimate the ability of your students to understand difficult material. They will get better as they do it over and over. With your help guiding them, they're going to understand it. I had a primary source, I don't remember the card, but I thought, oh, they'll never understand this. I barely get it. I read it 100 times, so we read it. And so I'll read a little portion, and I'll say, who can tell me what he's saying? And so I did that. I read, and I thought, they're going to look at me like that. Somebody got up and said, this is what that paragraph was about. And then all of a sudden, all the others went, I got it too. I understood that too. I knew that too. And I said, that's not because you're Mensa students. You're not. I said that to them. They don't know what that means. I wouldn't say that to their parents. But anyhow, I said, that comes from the hard work that it has taken you week after week after week after week to read difficult passages and work hard to understand them so they can do it. Don't ever say, I don't think they'll get it, okay? They can get it, and you can help them do it, okay? So make sure it's pertinent and give them meat. All right, so did I already do that one? Well, there's my Pliny letters right there in the center. That's the one right there. I didn't use that one. That one's in Latin. I used this one for some nice, pleasant nighttime reading. All right. So after I've made my selection, I cut and paste it, and I put it in a document. This document, the one that I used here, I actually had a picture a painting of the scolding of Pliny. And so it's a funny story. You need to read those letters. But anyhow, it was a painting about that. I couldn't get it into this document. But this is what we do. I tell them, let's read our primary source. Thank you, Mrs. Phillips. And they're ready. I tell them what to highlight. Older grammar students should be able to highlight, to pick out main ideas. Third graders cannot do that yet. And so we just go quickly. They got faster as we went through the year. I said, on the first, highlight the first three lines. Go down to the 10th line, highlight the next two lines. Go to the middle of the 12th line, highlight to the end of the paragraph. Things like that. They got really good at it, okay? They didn't draw. They didn't color. This primary source time is it's an exciting time for them, and they love it, okay? And so we highlight it. After we highlight the main ideas, we go back, and I read the entire handout, the entire selection that I gave them. And I check for comprehension as we go. I rarely tell them what it's about. I can't even pull up an instance where I had to tell them what the paragraph was about, because if they give me an answer and it's not quite on track, I'm going to just use their answer to springboard to the right path, okay? So resist the urge to interpret for them. Let them do the work of that, and you are just the tour guide. You just ask a question. You might need to go different directions, but you ask the question and let them do the work of it. We spend a little extra time on important passages or difficult passages, but I'll always say, does it support what we already know? And either it does or it doesn't. I always thought that Constantine saw the vision in the sky, heard the voice say in the sign conquer, at night. Where else would you best see a flaming cross at night, wouldn't you? You wouldn't see that in the daytime. But when I got that book by Eusebius, he saw it at noon. I was like, oh my goodness. So I went to my students. I said, guess what I found? It wasn't at night. It was, and we looked at it, it was at noon, okay? I have the students restate the main points. I'll say, what are the three main points of this document? I usually start with my student that I know has it, and they'll say it. And then I'll ask another student. I'll work my way down so that the student who struggles the most has heard it four or five times and can articulate that for me, okay? And then every day, what are the three main points of the Edict of Milan? I'm going to start with that student that struggled, just to see if he got it, having heard it so many times, okay? And then I'll ask them, what do you still want to know about Nero or Constantine? Okay? All right. Here is a worksheet that I use as a primary source. You have a copy. The close-up looks like this. I'll show you. And you have a copy of that. You can make it your own. I actually got the idea for this from several different websites. So you just cut and it's morphed over the year, and I'll probably change it for next year. But you can see that I'm asking them to identify, we meet the document, what is the name of the document, who wrote the document, who read or received the document, what is the date of the document? What's the original language? I have a little dictionary work right here. Write down two words you didn't understand. Now, I don't let them read that primary source on their own. Third graders cannot do that. I read that to them. That is a very special time for us together and very important for their understanding. So we'll have already read it and discussed it before we ever get to this little worksheet. I do not do this worksheet every week. And if you were listening to George Grant, you know why. There are not enough hours. We try to make sense of the document. What is the main idea? I give them an opportunity to tell me two things that they enjoyed, two quotes that support it, and then something they found interesting about the letter 16, about how Pliny's uncle died. They thought that they all loved that he was fat, and that when he left Misenum and went over to Pompeii to help rescue people, first he had a bath, He got rubbed down with oil, had a big meal, and he laid down, took a nap, and slept a long time because he was so fat. So they like things like that, you know, if you don't move them on. But I wanted to give them the opportunity to say, I love this primary source document. And I told you the main idea, but I really liked this other thing. I really like that Alexander the Great died, rinsed his hair in saffron so it'd be that brassy orange that we pay big bucks not to have, you know. Supplemental materials, there's the card art pieces and artifacts and so forth, okay? All right, so let's see how we're doing. I'm looking at my time. We found our primary sources. I showed you how to choose selections. We're going to now make a change, and we're going to go into art and how to curate art. And I'm telling you, it's a change in the direction because your artwork is not always a primary source, okay? So if you look at the bull leaping fresco in the Palace of Manoa, of Palace of Gnosis, that is a primary source. It was painted at the time of the event. It tells us a lot about ancient Greece, ancient culture, about the Cretans on the island of Crete. And so it is. But the statue of Romulus and Remus and the she-wolf is not a primary source. It's a major artwork. You want them to know it, but you don't want them to think that's where we got the idea of the she-wolf. In fact, it was made hundreds of years after the fact, and hundreds of years after that, they added the Romulus and the Remus down underneath the she-wolf. The statue of the discus thrower, that is a Renaissance statue. That's a copy of Myron's bronze copy, which was hundreds of years B.C. This was made in the Renaissance era, not a primary source, but you want them to know that discus thrower. All right, here's your job. It's very simple. You are searching and you are curating your art. So I've given you all those places on your handout where you can go to get art. And don't write off Wikipedia. There is a wealth of art, original art on Wikipedia. I wish I had time to tell you about all my favorite sites because some of them you just keep clicking and going and going. And that's why you have to curate. You cannot show all the art that accompanies a history event. It's too broad, too much. You want to pick the most significant pieces, the ones that they will recognize immediately anytime they open an art book, every single time. If you know your students, one of your students is going on vacation to a particular city where there's an art museum, do a little checking, find out what's there. Show those pieces. So when they get there, they go, oh, I know what that is, okay? And so you want to search. It's this easy. You just search for it, cut and paste it onto your PowerPoint or however you display your artwork, and then make sure that you curate carefully. You pick the most important ones. Here is something else you need to do. You need to make sure you have done your homework and you know about the piece. Okay, so if you look at this piece right here, I've not given you the full title. It's the crucifixion with some people, okay? And I said, oh, it's Michelangelo. It's got to be a good one. And so I put that in my art for the week. This was crucifixion, resurrection, ascension. And so as we looked at this piece of art, we could not agree on who this person is. So somebody said, that is Elizabeth. And somebody else said, can't be Elizabeth. She was old already before Jesus was born. That's why the birth of John the Baptist was a miracle. So she's really old, and that doesn't look like an old person, okay? So they knew that was going to be Mary. Most of what we had looked at, Mary was in blue. And so we went back and forth. Well, that's not helpful if nobody has the answer. So I said, please forgive me. I did not read about this painting. I'll do a little bit more searching and we'll come back to it. And so does anybody know who this is? Here's another thing. This is, they'll take what they learned somewhere else and they'll bring it to this table. We had had a lesson from one of our logic rhetoric teachers on the Last Supper. And he was asking them to identify somebody. And it was John the Apostle. And one of the students said, that looks like a woman. And he explained in Renaissance art, often men that were young were painted. So they looked like women, okay? And so now, after I did my homework, I came back, and this is not a woman. This is a man, and it's John. And the title is Crucifixion with Mary and John. This is the scene where Jesus is saying to John, this is now your mother, okay? So it pays to do your homework, okay? Also, one of them noticed there's a skull at the base of the cross, and they did not know the legend of when David killed Goliath. So once the question was asked, what did David do to Goliath? Well, he took the sword and chopped off his head. I just had to fill in the gap. Legend has it that David brought that skull back and buried it here at Golgotha, the place of the skull. So another one said, oh, David is a Christ figure. Goliath is a figure of the seed of the serpent. Just like David crushed the head of the seed of the serpent, Jesus will crush the head of the serpent. That is what this project has done this year, to take what they learned there and apply it elsewhere. Okay, let's move on. So this is your student's job. Three things. That's all you need to do. Three things. And they do all the work. They observe, they comment, and they interpret. So the first thing they do is they observe. I'm going to go to this side, share the wealth with y'all. Just looking at this painting. It's a very beautiful painting. It's by Raphael. It's Madonna in the meadow. And the first thing we do is we just observe. It's very simple. We just tell what's in the picture. So here we have a woman. We have two babies. And they're sitting in a field. And they wondered about some of the stuff in the background, too. Okay, just tell him what it is. And then they make comments. The woman is in blue. One of the babies has a rough cloth tied around his belly. One of them is naked. They're both holding on to some sort of staff or stick. Okay? And then we start making interpretations. The woman, they said, well, since most of what we've looked at about Mary, she's in blue, this must be Mary. And so then we had a little conversation. They went back and forth. Well, who's who in the who are the babies? And so this is what my students did. I did not do any of this for them. This rough-looking cloth, John the Baptist grew up and wore camel's hair. And this is something rough-looking. So this must be John the Baptist. Mary has her hands on this baby, so this must be Jesus. And they both have their hands on here, but Jesus's hand is above John the Baptist's hand. John the Baptist said, there's one coming who is greater than I. And so they made those connections, okay? Now, my job this summer is to learn a little bit more about art and art history because I know very little about it. I've peaked at third grade, just in case you didn't know that. But anyhow, this style, they've learned to look where the light is because that's where your eye goes immediately. And so we look at the light. They love trying to figure out why the expression is as it is on the face in any painting, okay? But this period of art, had a wide base and a narrow apex, a nice triangular, sort of gave it a good foundation, okay? We're not going to talk about the other one except to say that they told me both the man and the lamb had halos, which means they're holy in some way, okay? And so look at what he's pointing to. He's pointing to what? The lamb. And so this picture is John the Baptist, and he's pointing to the lamb as to say what? Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. They did like to tell me the city's in the background because John didn't live in the city. He lived in the wilderness. They will find things. They can find a halo anywhere, I'm telling you. Sometimes I can't always see them. You must go in this order. Do not let them interpret right out of the starting gate. They just simply tell what they see. Then they can make comments on it, and then we'll draw conclusions. All right. Yay, it's working. Okay. I'm going to run out of time, but I want to show you this. I want to tell you, our school's had a policy for decades that we don't show videos in the classroom, but I am telling you, there are videos out there that are worth watching. They are well done. They are historic. They are accurate. They are well done. They're not cheesy cartoons. Stay away from those. I just want to show you a couple of seconds from a few of these. So this next one is the treasury of Atreus. It's a tholos. If you've ever heard of a tholos, is a beehive tomb. For years, I've said, all right, ladies and gentlemen, here is a picture of a tholos, a beehive tomb. And they go, ooh. And you don't get, but on the video, they take a tour. This is Khan Academy. If you don't know Khan Academy, it's in your resources. You need to get to know them. But they take a tour through a tholos. It's huge. It's massive. You do not get that perspective. My class will probably never go to Mycenae and walk through a tholos. I would love to. I hope some of them can. But they can see somebody else do that. So let me just see if this will work for a few minutes. And nope, it's not going to. Okay. You go to Khan Academy and you can... oh, there it goes. Yes.
Just down the hill from Mycenae, the great citadel of the Mycenaeans, the Bronze Age Greek mainland people that traded as far away as Italy and North Africa, there is, in a hill, an enormous tomb, which is sometimes known as the Treasury of Atreus.
Or the Tomb of Agamemnon.
The type of tomb that we're looking at is called a tholos, or a beehive tomb. And this is one of two
Look
types of tombs at Mycenae. These are the larger of the two types. The other are shaft graves within a larger circle, but the tholos are truly monumental, and this is the largest of them all.
I wish we had ours. It's a wonderful. This one is the biotapestry.
Just down the hill from
the
Mycenae, the great citadel
Nobody?
Of the Mycenaeans, the Bronze Age Greek mainland people that traded as far away as Italy.
Here we go. This is an animated biotapestry which tells the story of William the Conqueror in the Battle of Normandy. And they animated it. It's so well done. This one is about the Alexander Mosaic in Pompeii. I don't know how to get the bar to move.
In baseball, in soccer, sometimes sports announcers will look for the turning point of the game. And the scene that we're looking at, a battle, not sport, in fact, one of the most important battles in ancient history, is at that particular turning point, the moment when the great ruler of Persia turns and flees under the onslaught of the great Greek general Alexander.
Darius, the king of the Persians, has just ordered...
Okay, now I can't get the cursor, so let me see. Okay. All right. We're not going to read this. You have a copy of this in your handouts. These are ideas about projects for art, not for the card or the event necessarily, but for art. So you can look at that again. I love projects. I really love projects. But I'm telling you that doing a project for your history card is like the strings on Pinocchio. They'll make the puppet move. I can make the puppet dance with a project. Most children, they love a project. It's fun to do, okay? It goes home, and the mosaic becomes a trivet for the dining room table, things like that. The basket, the woven basket becomes a pencil cup. Projects are great. I'm not saying that they're not, but they're like the strings. Primary sources, I'm telling you, breathe life. They turn the puppet into a boy, and that's much richer, okay? So here we go. Let's see if I can get my cursor back. There we go. So now I'm just going to talk real fast about maps. Did it not go? Okay, there we go. Here's the deal on maps. Make sure you have a classroom map, a good map. Go to the map every day. Tell the story at the map. Have your students go to the map. Tell the story of the map. When you do the Persian Wars, have one student put his finger up over where Macedonia is on the land and another one in the water to show how the Persians... one set of warriors came on the land, one followed them in the water. Go to the map and tell the story. That's where history happened. It didn't happen in a vacuum somewhere. Have close-up maps, maps that are interactive, maps that they color, maps that they figure out where they are. Make sure you have a globe. Put your finger on Atlanta, Georgia. Swim across the Atlantic Ocean. Make your way through the Pillars of Hercules. Go through the Mediterranean Sea. Land on Italy. Use your maps. When we do Persian Wars, we color a map. I have circles with numbers, no cities. And they color it. We laminate it. And then I have a card game that I made where they pull a card, and whatever the number is, it's what happened at that number. And it'll have a question. If they give the right answer, they could put an M&M on it. At the end of the game, we eat our M&Ms, wipe it off, use it the next day. So make sure that you're using maps. Big wall map. Go every day. Take your students. Join me. I say, join me at the map, and they can't wait to get there. All right. Graphic organizers. I told you this is another one of my favorites. I have had so much fun doing graphic organizers. And this is just an example. On this one, I had a very short primary source. You can see it there on the left. When this document folds together, it's an 8.5 by 11. I'll have art. I'll have worksheet questions. On this particular one, instead of drawing out the buildings and edifices in Rome in the Forum, I had them draw it. And then we wrote short descriptions of that. Here's another one. I've given you one that's filled out. This one is the split of the Roman Empire. And so we have a couple of maps on here. Have where they have a piece of artwork and a bust of Diocletian. They love the regnal names of the emperors. Worksheet questions. You'll notice the one in your packet has some misspellings. That's an average third grade work that you'll see in there. Normally we do try to correct our spelling, but I'm not kidding. It's almost trivial some weeks for me to take time to do that when I've given them a wealth in all of these other things. So do what you can and don't feel guilty about it, and I won't either. So there's a copy of this one in your packet, one that's already filled out, okay? The other thing, I'm out of time, but this is the Seven Laws lesson plan that our school has used over the last couple of years, and I'm not kidding. This is the tool that I use to get those creative juices going. When you sit down and you have to figure out how to gain the interest of your students and help them attend with interest, I'm not telling them, sit in ready position, I want to do it. And you'll see that one's the architectural advances in Rome. We have building blocks. I give everybody some different Legos and so forth, and they build something to start. What child doesn't like that? Oh, my goodness, I've got their attention before I ever get started. So you have a copy of that. You also have the resources, tons of them. I just had a few. And so let's see if we did everything that I had for us to do today. Done and done. And we did that and we did that. And so here is that slide I told you I'd go back to. The perks of doing primary sources. Intense interest in the lesson. Affection for deeper knowledge. The ability to read and understand difficult selections, skill in observing and interpreting art, engagement in the learning process, an increased level of logic, that taking Genesis 3:15 and applying it to Michelangelo's painting, remember? And then that pursuit of knowledge. And we did it. I think we finished. Yay. And I've given you my email address and my name in your handout. Feel free to email me. I would love to help you in any way because some people have helped me so much. Thank you for coming.